And what we've been doing in church is going through the book of Romans. Some of these have been quite challenging topics in terms of those who have been speaking, because the arguments in Romans are really quite complicated and quite challenging. But the passage today is really quite practical and down to earth. And today in Romans chapter 13, we're thinking about the Christian in a pagan society, especially in relation to their duty to the state, to the government, and also the response to our neighbour in terms of love. As I studied this, I went on the web just to see what others had said about it. And John Piper, who's a very good preacher, church leader in America, on Romans 13, took 9 sermons. So this is actually a fascinating topic, and it would probably do as well, if we wanted to take this seriously, to have a Saturday morning worship workshop on Romans chapter 13, because the implications are actually quite serious for us as we live our lives. They're down to earth and they're practical in terms of what's being said about our relationship and our responsibility in society. It was right that Paul, and if you've got your Bible and just follow through as I speak, that might be more helpful. There will be no pictures this morning. But if you've got your Bible open at Romans 13, that might be quite helpful. It really was quite key that Paul spoke about the relationship of the Christian in a pagan environment to the government and the state. Because at that time, Christianity was seen as a Jewish sect and potentially was subversive and dangerous to the Roman Empire. Remember, Jesus had spoken a lot about the kingdom of God as well. And so with that kind of language going on, perhaps there was a need for Paul to realign the expectations of Christians that there should be no revolutionary response in terms of arms or anything else against the Roman Empire. And I think Paul also knew about the impact that the lives of Christians could make in a pagan environment for the gospel as they lived for Jesus. And so he's kind of saying, don't become radical revolutionaries, but through your life and through respect for the government, respond in an appropriate way. And maybe even Paul was writing this because at the time that he wrote, it wasn't happening, but it wasn't going to be very soon before to be a Christian was almost impossible. In the sense that the Roman emperor demanded that they should take a pinch of incense, drop it on the altar, and affirm that Caesar was God. So you begin to see the kind of tensions that are going on here and why Paul perhaps writes. And as he writes, he addresses everybody, every Christian person, which emphasizes that this is much more about our personal citizenship and responsibility in society, rather than this being some kind of theory about church and state relations. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think Paul's just saying, this is how you should live, and this is your response to the authorities. In the earlier part of the chapter, if you kind of look at it, and if you were paying attention to it as it was read, it's actually pretty strong stuff. Because he issues a clear command and says that everybody must submit to the governing authorities. The authorities are established by God, and there's no authority that exists apart from which God has established. If you rebel against the authorities, you rebel against what God has ordained. Now, if you're a thinking Christian, immediately there'll be all sorts of questions coming up in your mind. And we'll go there eventually, but not just at the moment. What Paul's saying is believers have to recognize that the institutions of the state are from God and to respect them. If you were a Christian in China this morning or during the past 30 years, I wonder how you would respond to that statement. If you were a Christian paying taxes in Zimbabwe today and saw all of that money going into the pockets of the leadership and all the abuses that are going on, I wonder how you would respond to that statement. There's challenges there, and we'll look at that just in a minute. But what Paul's saying here, in one sense, isn't new. He's agreeing with the Old Testament.
He's agreeing with what Jesus said, and he's agreeing with what Peter said. In the Old Testament, in Daniel 4, verse 25, you read that Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, "You will know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and he gives it to whoever he wills." Same kind of emphasis, that the authorities are instituted by God. What did Jesus say in Mark 12? "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things which are God's." And Jesus just begins to open a wee chink of light as to how we might respond when there's an abuse of governmental power. Paul is saying here, hey, this issue of your relationship with the state is a God thing. Respect the government, keep its laws, and participate in society. And he goes on to say, if you don't submit, then you're rebelling, and you're setting yourself up against what God has instituted. So what's going on here is not the right or wrong about government policies or the detail of that. Paul is really just showing that in order for society to function, for people to live in peace, for there to be a decent rule of law, and even for the gospel to progress, there needs to be order and stability, and God's means of doing that is the ordination of government. And that kind of leaves us with a question. Should Christians be a role model of citizens in society? If you look down the next few verses, Paul not only says that the government has been instituted by God, but he says that the government is God's servant or minister. Verse 4a, God's servant to do good. Verse 4c, God's servant and the agent of wrath to bring punishment. Verse 6, the authorities are God's servants. Paul uses the same word here for servants as he does for deacons in a church. And in verse 6, he uses the word that's used in Scripture for priest, i.e. those that are working on behalf of the people. So that kind of says to me that public servants who serve the state as legislators, civil servants, magistrates, police, social workers, teachers, are ministers of God in the environment in which he has placed us. That kind of adds a bit of value to the job of a social worker, doesn't it? Or the role of a teacher. Not just there for professional reasons, but actually as a Christian, there as salt and light in society and as a minister of God. We should pray for those who are in these kind of positions, not just because they serve us, but with the mentality of the good functioning of society and the challenge for us as Christians to support them. And so Paul, further down the passage, says the function of the state is to promote and reward good and to restrain and punish wrongdoing. So the formulation of legislation, the enforcement of it, punishment, protection and preservation of the values of society have all been invested in the state and in the authorities from God for our good and our benefit. I wonder if, as a church here in the UK, we've allowed ourselves to be pushed into a backwater so that our voice in society isn't heard. The state has taken over many of the charitable things that churches and Christians used to do, and we've just closed our mouths. On the 31st of January, I cut out a section from The Guardian, which was a piece on Steve Chalk. You'll know who Steve Chalk is, most of us. And this is what Steve Chalk says in this particular article. "In 1921, my church had 9 medical staff and ran a clinic, but the state took off the churches their welfare role. Everything was left to the state. The church was made redundant and left us singing and boring ourselves to death. But the church is an agency of social activism. Jesus was an activist before he was a preacher. We need to rebuild active communities." Actually, the article goes on, it's quite a long article, about how Steve Chalk has been involved in schools,
and he would like to move into hospitals through his charity called Oasis. And that kind of raised a question for me about the resources of the church here in the UK, here in Bristol, how we're using that, both in terms of people and finance. What kind of impact are we really having for God in our communities because we understand God's pattern and purpose for society? I don't want any medics here to take this wrongly, but if the Christian church in Bristol and Christian medics in Bristol, of whom there are many, got together, could we not make a significant impact in some of the poorer parts of our city for God? I really believe we could, and I actually believe that we should. Christians often start Christian schools. And I find that very interesting, because it's not for the benefit of society, it's for the benefit of our own children. Very interesting. Why have we not started houses for the homeless, or whatever it might be? There's a real challenge for us here. And that's when I was speaking at the beginning about having a workshop on a Saturday morning or whatever. Why are we not? If we're going to do something about Romans chapter 13, then we need to be serious about some of these issues. I think there's a number of interesting things that flow from this. Because we're seeing here that the state honours, or Paul's saying, the state honours what's good and punishes what's wrong. That actually implies that the state knows what's good and what's wrong. And there's been an issue for me since about last October, where I really began to get a bit annoyed and frustrated and angry about some of the policies in terms of sex education, whole range of things, policies which are driven by a secular humanist agenda, and there is no Christian voice. There's another article here by Stuart Jeffries in The Guardian again, and this article is saying, if you think the clash of worldviews in the UK today is between Christianity and Islam, you're absolutely wrong. The clash of worldviews in the UK today is between religious values and secular humanism. And that's what the agenda is being driven by. And I really do believe we need to take seriously our responsibility in the workplace and in society, in local authorities, and impact our society with the values that we have. I was flabbergasted, and you may think I'm a bit naive because I don't know this, but I was flabbergasted this week that the report on drugs was put together by the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts. Where does that come from? The Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts putting together a drug policy report. I looked up on the website to see what the Royal Society of the Encouragement of Arts was. And its mission statement in 1921, I think, was, the manifesto was to embolden enterprise, to enlarge science, to refine arts, and to improve our manufactures and extend our commerce. What's that got to do with drugs? Don't know. But actually, I think we have got something to say in areas like that. So these are some of the things I think that Paul's saying as he speaks about our response in society to government. And he says that, you know, this is an issue of conscience. And that conscience is practically expressed in the last few verses there in the payment of our taxes and in playing our part in the life of the nation and in its institutions. Christians should accept their tax liability and give proper esteem to those who collect them, including traffic wardens. So that's what Paul's saying. I want to come now to what he's not saying. What Paul is not saying here is that Stalin, Saddam Hussein, and George Bush were personally appointed by God, that God's responsible for all of their behaviour, and that we should never resist their authority. God's intention of good government sometimes is abused. I don't think Paul's ignoring the fact
that a government can make wrong judgments or there can be abusive regimes, because he had experienced the benefits of Roman justice. But he also knew that there were miscarriages of justice. For example, the death of Jesus was an absolute miscarriage of justice, and he would have known that. In Acts 25 and 11, he speaks about being dissatisfied with a judgment on his behalf by a provincial government, and speaks about taking it as an appeal to Caesar. So Paul knew that there would be miscarriages of justice. He knew that there would be those who would abuse their power. But in these verses, that's not what he's speaking about. However, I do think we need to address the question, what happens if rulers abuse their authority? What do we do? Do we sit there docile and just accept it? I don't think so. Because in the Bible, there's lots of examples of civil disobedience. Remember Moses' mother? When Pharaoh decreed that all newborn children had to be put to death, she disobeyed the authorities and saved her son. Remember in Daniel? Daniel was told, no praying, mate. But he went, and he opened his windows, he flaunted the law, and he prayed to God. And many other cases like that. And in each case, it wasn't that they wanted to rebel against the government. But the issue was, it was a higher priority to obey and honour God and to be subject to him. I believe that at the very least, under circumstances where justice is collapsing, the Christian community is obliged to voice its criticism of failures in the state and in state government. If we believe that God has appointed institutions for the fair running of society and that isn't happening, then I really do think that we have got responsibility for that. If it abuses its authority, if it requires citizens to disobey what God has already said, if it's riddled with corruption, then I do think we really need to stand up. And in fact, I would go further and say that it's possible that civil disobedience may actually become a Christian duty for us. I believe that we should be peaceful, non-violent, but protest, and that's actually very legitimate. Two examples that I can think of is people on the streets in Ukraine and also in that Roman Catholic country in Asia, in the Philippines. They overthrew the government just by peacefully going on the streets and sitting down and not moving until the government gave in. So I think that's absolutely legitimate for us to do. And again, this brings it back to us. I think we should rejoice and give thanks that in the UK there are many courses possible to voice our opinion and to protest. Even Jamie Oliver did that. And they've got decent school meals in our schools. But seriously, I do think that we need to take a role in society seriously. And when there are issues, we ought to challenge them. The other thing that Paul's not saying here is that one particular form of government is better than another. And that's actually quite a big discussion. I get a wee bit wound up when I hear the phrase, George Bush used it, and so did our own Tony Blair, when they spoke about exporting democracy. That winds me up badly. I believe that Western democracy is good, but it might not actually be the ideal method of government in every cultural context. What right have we got to export democracy? And in fact, it becomes quite an issue because there are those who may have severe right-wing views. And there may be some political philosophies which are built on passages like Romans 13, which actually have strong aspects of them that are completely unbiblical, even tending towards dictatorship. So I think there are some interesting issues for discussion coming out of this passage. I'd just like to take 5 minutes more to speak on verse 8 to 10. Because this passage on the government is wedged between chapter 12 and verse 20 and chapter 13 and verse 9. chapter 12 and verse 20, Paul speaking about a response to loving our enemy. And in chapter 13:9, he's speaking about loving her neighbor, our neighbour. And he uses the idea of debt to link this. He says, we've got to pay our taxes and our debts, but actually there's one debt that's not very easy to settle, and it's our debt to love our fellow human being. It's like a credit card that you can never clear. Every day, there's somebody to love. Every day, there's somebody to respond to. Now, I don't think that means that we should be driven by guilt or drive ourselves into the ground, but I think it does mean that we need to be alert to who we are, what kind of agenda we're running, and what our social concern really is. Paul in verse 9 gives typical examples of what the Ten Commandments lay down regarding our neighbours. So we've not to steal, we've not to murder, we've not to take our friend's wife. All of these things are outlined there. And Paul, sometimes we've got this idea that the law is bad and love is positive. I don't see it like that. I think the law helps us to see what we need to do, and love gives us the motivation to actually do it. And if we're loving people, we ain't going to be sinning against them. So in that sense, we're fulfilling the law, the Ten Commandments. We ain't going to steal. I'm not going to steal against John Ogburn if I love him. And so if we love, we fulfill the law. This word neighbour that Paul uses is a lovely word. Do you know what it means? It means the one who is near. The one who is near. And I actually think that without any great big fanfare, or without any great lauding of ourselves, this is not about the big picture, about government and about politics and everything else. This is about John Aiken this afternoon, when I walk out that door, what I do in my life and how I respond to other people. About 2 weeks ago, the girls, Pearl and I, went for lunch to the Tinto Cafe in Gloucester Road. And I was walking by the phone box, and there was a girl, probably in her mid-20s, maybe 30, slumped against the telephone box with two bags of shopping. And she really was in a bit of a state. And I thought, what do we do here? Do we carry on for a lunch, or do I stop? I carried on for my lunch, because I thought she was drunk, but actually she could have had an epileptic fit. And as we sat in the Tinto Cafe, I was very, very convicted. So I went to move my car, and she had gone. And I think that's where this begins to hit the road. In terms of, the best example of all of this is the Good Samaritan. The priests and the Levites, they found their nearness to the injured person a source of embarrassment. And there was a sense in which we had our own agenda going up to the Tinto Cafe, because Pearl had been away, I had been away, we needed that as a family time. But actually, what was the priority? The Samaritan saw it as an opportunity to help his neighbour, and he overcame his prejudice. And so, just to finish, love calls us to overcome our prejudice. It calls us to care for those who are not our own. It asks us to give of ourselves. It asks us to give up time and finance. It asks us to be inconvenienced. It requests us to abandon our own agenda. It may even invite us to be dirty. Where do we go with all of this? Well, there's another section, but I ain't going to speak on that. What I'm going to ask Hervé to do is just stick up a slide. And as we move into a time of communion, perhaps just reflect on this. And even as we come to communion, make this a time of confession. Everybody knows these words. But actually, I'm sure there's not a person in here who could identify something that needs to be changed, an apology that needs to be made, or an attitude that needs to be confessed. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love doesn't envy. I wonder if you ever envy. It does not boast. It's not proud. It's not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. I don't find that an easy one. I love to keep a record of wrongs. In the house, Pearl, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. This second word here, it always protects. That's quite a strong word, isn't it? Always, it always, it always protects. Always trusts. Always hopes. Always perseveres. The Bible's great. It's not just all theory. It's very down to earth and practical. And so, when I walk up White Ladies Road today, that's where this begins to work. And the Gospel's not all about bashing folks over the head with a Bible. But it does call us to wake up, to get dressed, and to get organised. I love on a day off to... I don't have long lives, but what I really love to do is just get up and just wander about the house with my pyjamas on and get the paper and read it and relax. In some working days, I get up at 6:45 and I go up onto the downs and I jog for 25 minutes, then I come back and have a shower, have my breakfast, try and have a time of prayer, and by 9 o'clock, I'm ready to start work. And on those days, my mind is sharp and active and ready to go. But when I get up and it's my day off, you know, my mind's lazy and I'm relaxed and it's all chilled. And actually, these kind of two pictures are a challenge to us about where we're at in these issues. As a Church of Jesus Christ, are we like John on a day off? Or as Paul is encouraging us here, hey, wake up, get dressed, and get on with the business. May we be encouraged to do that, and may we serve the Lord well in our own context, in the environment that he's put us in here in Bristol. May God bless his word to us.